Starting out, we discussed a few weeks ago Apple's first ever shot on iPhone contest, where you could submit your iPhone shot photo through Twitter or Instagram or I think what's the Chinese social media?
Weibo.
Weibo, yeah.
Yeah.
Or you could email it directly and use the hashtag shot on iPhone, and Apple would pick 10 winners, and they did. And they had a newsroom release this week where they showed all of the winners and you know, the photographers who took the photos, where they're from, and what the pictures were, and some commentary from the judges, including Phil Schiller. So
yeah, and the winning photos will be, obviously you can see them on this page, but also they're going to be included in like some shot on iPhone ad campaign kind of things with billboards and some cities, and then on retail store like display and stuff.
Yeah, they had a, like, they're already on Apple.com. There's a tile on the homepage where you can see, like, I guess all, they're showing all of them there. And I think I've already seen, like, maybe one place where they're on a, where one is on a billboard, maybe. And on Instagram, they had, like, one story where, you know, you can post, like, multiple pictures to one post. And so they had the 10 images on a single Instagram post. But your point was, when will Apple figure out that they can do that on Twitter too? You know, post photos.
Yeah, Apple accounts still zero tweets. Come on,
yeah,
come on. That's the, if I like randomly walked into Phil Schiller on the street, I feel like that would be my go to question, because, you know, questions about like product rumors and stuff he's never going
to
talk about.
But what happened to AirPower? No, wait, where's Twitter?
Yeah, like even the AirPower thing. Like, yeah. I want the answer to that for sure. But yeah. it's going to come out, I swear. But he's not going to say that. But he might be like, oh, we just don't use Twitter because of blah. Like, someone needs to keep that on the list the next time they interview them.
Yeah.
But yeah, and like the Instagram thing, they even on the newsroom post, they even subtitle every picture with the Instagram handle. So you get like a little back reference to find the original authors. And on many, you can go back on their feed and find when they took the photo. Like the one with the
raccoon. Right?
Yeah, the raccoon. Yeah. I was going to say, I was going to say bear, but yeah, raccoon. that one is originally taken from like November. The person who took it is called Blake Marvin. And interestingly, on his Instagram feed, he did it in color, but when he submitted it, he edited it to be black and white. So you kind of get like a, oh, this is, they went from the original source image to this is what they actually thought was good to submit.
Interesting. Yeah. 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 And like the pictures, they kind of just really fit in a big way with like Apple's existing marketing material. Like they often show like urban, construction and vivid colors, and then some like, you know, very different like plain landscapes and things like that. One of the things is included is a person walking and then their reflection in a puddle, you know, mirrored, which is like a photography cliche, but in this case the puddle is in the shape of a heart, so it's like a new twist on that. There's another photo that is I think it's like graffiti on a wall, but then it's through glass and there's like raindrops all over the glass. And so the one big scene of graffiti is like miniaturized in every little raindrop. And that one, it just like it speaks to me, like it's neat and it's kind of a neat wallpaper even. So, you know, I think these are nice photos. It was a cool contest, and I imagine they'll repeat it maybe the same time next year or so. It's a good idea, and I think it went well.
Yeah, and they pick photos not just taken from the latest models. Like, they have images from iPhone 7s.
Yeah, it's a good point. They call it out that the iPhone 7 and through XS Max were the models on some of the winning photos, and they even use that to, like, to speak to the quality of older iPhones in the press release.
Similar to the iPad ads where it was, like, shot on iPad, you kind of want to see the behind the scenes in these pictures, which obviously they don't have.
Because made on taken, iPad, I think, was the...
Yeah, made with that. Yeah, made on iPad. But and obviously filmed with the iPad as well. But here it's like, I kind of want to see how these pictures are taken, but they, you know, because this isn't an actual ad, these are just submissions from photographers around the world. They don't have that backstory to tell you. Because the always problem with whether it's, you know, you're on the keynote stage and they're showing sample pictures or these kind of contests is like, it never feels like I can take those pictures myself, just because... I don't know. I never feel like the pictures I take with the camera look as good as, you know, professional photographers, which is why they're professionals and I'm not. But being able to tell that story kind of gives like that kind of connection.
Mm.
When it's just plain like this, it's almost like, you know, more abstract and hard to you know, truly relate to, because it's like, these pictures are cool, but I could never actually do it myself. And there's no promise that these photos, you mentioned the wallpaper thing, it would have been a pretty cool gimmick if they'd have said, and these photos will be, you know, some of these pictures we choose will be available in future versions of iOS as selectable wallpaper. That'd be like a cool twist on it, because obviously, you know, they're featuring them, but then they're presumably going to go away and the photographers get a license fee, but that's about it. Like, I feel like if they had actually said, especially that bubble one could almost be an iOS wallpaper today. Like, it fits in really well into that kind of abstract photo. And the others are kind of reminiscent of some of the older wallpapers they did before, like, the iOS 7 era. But, yeah, it's like, it's hard for me to believe that these pictures were taken with no additional hardware, but I assume, you know, Apple did the due diligence of actually checking that out.
Yeah, I mean, can you fake, like, the EXIF data? Because that's nothing you
can do. I mean, you can fake anything.
That's true. Yeah, no, they totally feel like iPhone photography to me, at least. And I think it maybe just depends on, like, your eye for things, too. Like, if you see, it isn't like, can you recreate what they did? Like, I'm sure that if you went to the same spot, like, in front of that basketball goal, in front of the very colorful building behind it, with, like that you could capture that same photo, because there's not much you can do. Like, you can do manual camera apps, but, like, with the default camera app, there's not a whole lot you can do. You can, like, change the focus, change the brightness level. There's not much you can do, though. So it's just, like, positioning, you know, framing it the right way, you know, tapping the button and going, like, so I think that's a lot of it. It's just, like, in seeing something around you and being like, that would be a cool photo, and, like, knowing how to frame it. And one thing in my experience from using my iPhone to take photos a lot of times, and then my Sony A6500 to take photos frequently as well, is that I can take way fewer photos on my iPhone and get what I wanted than I do on the Sony camera, like the big camera. Cause then it's like, I find that I have to take a lot more pictures, and sometimes there'll be like one good out of like 30. Which is like what I saw and wanted to capture, like, on the iPhone. I don't know if it's just like the difference of, like, with the way the viewfinder is and, like, tap controls and stuff like that, but or the magic of, like, all the intelligence that goes on behind the scenes for the iPhone. But I find that with the iPhone, I can take like five pictures and get like the one I wanted. Whereas on the big camera, it's like, I'm going to take way more to get like the one that I wanted. Maybe if I'm lucky, even things as simple as like, level, like having it as level as I wanted it to be, or like the just pulled back as much. So yeah, but it's a neat campaign, and there's a like, shot on iPhone isn't new. Like, this is something that's been a campaign for a long time. It's the contest that is new. There's another part to the shot on iPhone campaign this week to market the iPhone, you know, camera for photography, which is a partnership with the NHL, the National Hockey League, to have hockey players take pictures with the iPhone of other hockey players, like, out on the ice, and like, use those as advertisements around the hockey games, which is really clever, because these are like, you know, you think hockey players is like photographers. These are way more candid and in kind of like a rough environment. So like they could be like very poor pictures, but the ones that they're highlighting, at least, you know, are just like what you'd expect to take, you know, as like a friends or something. So I thought it was a clever campaign to have pictures of hockey players taken by hockey players as part of the campaign.
Yeah, they're a lot more personable for me than, you know, the professional pictures, because it does actually feel, you know, closer to home in a sense.
Yeah. One more thing I wanted to mention is we're recording on Wednesday, but we'll release this on Thursday. And the popular photography app, Halide, they've got their second ever app coming out on Thursday. And so by the time this is edited and released, we'll already be on the App Store. Spectre is a new app. And it is where Halide is a, you know, like, you've got the built-in camera app that's very, very basic and it does what it does. Halide is like, you get way more control. It's just, you know, another one of the manual camera apps that let you have access to controls before you take your picture. Spectre is very simple in that, like, you've got very few controls in what you do, but it's a long exposure camera app. And the idea there is that you can take a still shot of a busy touristy place, and the iPhone it has stabilization, but then Spectre has artificial intelligence powered stabilization that only works on the iPhone 8 or later because of the neural engine. So it's using that to power the feature, but it helps stabilize the image if you're not using a tripod. And then it can, by using that method, it can erase the people, all the movement in the picture. So you long exposure is you've got 3 seconds or 5 seconds or 9 seconds where the camera is like taking the picture. And you've got to be very still and steady, and it sees all the movement within that, you know, 3 to 9 seconds, and then it erases the movement and just saves the still scenery.
So it's kind of not the because obviously live photos that you have a long exposure option, and Apple markets that as when you're taking a picture of like a waterfall, you do live photo long exposure, and then it kind of blurs the motion together. Which is more of a traditional camera like long exposure, whereas Spectre seems more aimed at like if you take a picture of a road and then wait 9 seconds, it can delete all the cars that went past and you just get like the empty road.
And the camera app one was you take a normal photo and then you go into the Photos app and you swipe up to edit the live photo effect. And instead of being just live photo where you press into the image and it plays the movement before and after and the sound, you can change it to be a loop where it plays a part of it over and over without you touching it, or a balance where it starts and then rewinds and starts and rewinds without you touching it, or a long exposure. And so they're all like effects that you apply afterwards. Whereas this is like you press the button once and then like that's the shot, and it's still a live photo too. So you can even like press into the image and see what, you know, got erased in that example. But they also market it as, Halide is also the developers for Spectre also saying, you know, this can be used for pictures of water, because I think a lot of people don't know about the live photo feature that lets you do long exposure as an effect. And then this is like built for that, not just as like an after effect. But they also show like waterfalls and water moving, or the third option that they kind of promote is light trails. So like, cars moving at night, and like, you know, how you see the cool pictures of like all the headlights, like in the same direction to make like a beam of light, that kind of thing. And the app automatically goes between like daytime and nighttime, or you can change it to say like, it's daytime, but I want to capture light trails. So it's pretty neat. In the time since I've had the beta, like the app itself is simple to use. And I don't love like manual camera apps because you've got to learn them. and if they can't be the default, sometimes it isn't worth it. But in this case, like it's kind of a, you know, a one feature app for taking long exposure shots. And so it does something different than, not just better, but different than what the main camera app does. So I found the
I have Heli downloaded, and that's kind of a more general purpose, you know, camera app, but I just never use it because I forget. And it's like, the default camera is just so much easier to access. And at least in current iOS, there's no way to make that better. Like it would be nice if, you know, 13 or whatever, let you change the camera app on the lock screen, for instance, to be a third-party camera app versus like where you swipe just only the system camera. Or swipe over to that, you know, third-party app. But because that isn't possible, the default camera is like good enough for most scenarios. It's like, do I really need to go into this third-party app and do something else? Probably not. So you just get into the habit of only opening the iPhone camera. But with something like Spectre, it's more like you're in advance thinking, oh, I'm going to do one of these cool, you know, creative images. Let's open the app to make it happen.
Yeah. And it's like another mode that isn't in the camera app, but it's in another app. So, it's a neat app. And, I found it to be very approachable. I've not been in a situation where I want to take a long exposure image, and I've not like gone out shooting pictures yet. So I can't speak to like how well it works, but their demos are sample pictures, like really impressive and what they show they can do. So, I think it's $2 to buy now, and the price will go up eventually, but, just in terms of like the app design and everything, it's really nice. So, worth checking out Spectre is the name of the new app. This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by our friends at Hyper. This month, we've teamed up with Hyper for our first ever 9to5 Mac Deal of the Month, where we'll feature a great deal on quality accessories for Apple devices. For February, you can get the new Hyper Juice wireless charging case for AirPods for just $20, down from the usual $50 price tag. That's a great value for adding wireless charging to your existing AirPods. This is a new and improved second generation version of Hyper's wireless charging case, featuring a fully enclosed design and other improvements. Just insert the original Apple AirPods charging case inside the new Hyperjuice case, and you can wirelessly charge your AirPods with any Qi charger, just like your iPhone. And it has a design and look similar to the original case that comes with AirPods without being too bulky or looking cheap or added on. You can charge Apple's AirPods case back to full in just 1.5 hours, and a green LED will let you keep an eye on the charging status. Head to the show notes to get the Hyperjuice wireless charger case for AirPods for 60% off, making it just $20 for 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour listeners. Our thanks to Hyper for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mo, the next thing we want to discuss this week is largely around Apple's iPhone sales strategy and how they're marketing the XS and XR, XS Max, and the competition with foldable iPhones and everything now. It's been kind of a long conversation this iPhone cycle, and there's been a little bit of movement this week on how Apple's positioning the iPhone XS and XR and their trade-in program and everything. So the first thing, which I tweeted about on Tuesday night, is that Apple's homepage changed in a big way, which is that, like, we've been watching the homepage since the end of November, because they continue to tweak the marketing message for, like, their short pitch for what the XR is and what the XS is and how much it costs and how low you can obtain it for. And then they added the trade-in program, which is marketed as, like, limited time, and they kept, like, adjusting how it worked too. Well, now I think they finally landed on, like they figured out how they want to pitch the iPhone XR, XS and XR, and what the trade-in program will be going forward. The reason the website change caught my eye was because they've had, like, a black theme at the top for the trade-in program and the XR and the XS, and then everything below it was, like, a white theme for, like, the MacBook Air and other accessories. So, like, now it's all a white theme straight up and down, which is interesting. It just looks like kind of fresh now after a few months of the black theme. But they've tweaked the, I guess we'll break this down in sections. They've tweaked the limited time offer to the trade-in offer to not be limited time at all. Like, at the time of my tweet, limited time was off of the homepage, but when you click through to the trade-in learn more page, it was still there. And now it's gone there as well. It was just a matter of time before they removed it. So,
And this is something they started in, like, Japan and China last week. Mm-hmm. They started changing it, taking away the limited time language. And because this was kind of the joke, right? Is that it's the limited time offer beginning in November for the US and then rolled out to other countries in retail stores only in December.
Yeah.
But at the time, in some of the other regions like China, I think legally they have to put, like, the end date. So in the fine print, it would say ends 27th of January. And then the 27th of January would come around and they just extend the date to, right, oh, no, it's the 5th. So, yeah, the 25th of February. And then they've done it again. So it's like March the 25th is when China ends. But now the limited time has gone away. And now it's just like the permanent deal is this.
Right. And so it's still boosted trade-in values if you trade in if you trade in and then buy, like, trade in for a XS or XR, you get more than if you just traded in for, like, an iPhone 8, for example, right?
Yeah.
And so Apple is just going to say, going forward, we're okay with kind of eating the cost on the trade-in. And it does a few things. You know, limited time is like a classic, like, pressure tactic. You know, you see on the old, on like the info ads of, like, call now in the next 30 minutes to get this deal. Or, you know, a new app launches for a limited time price. Like, you want to buy it before the price goes up. In this case, Apple was saying limited time because they wanted you to feel like if you waited, you'd pay more for your iPhone. They wanted you to have an impulse upgrade. Well, now limited time's gone. It's just a pitch. Trade in your iPhone will give you, you know, credit towards a new one.
Which is better, like,
yes, much more on brand, at least.
But before this whole cycle of, you know, terrible sales, Apple would never put even a price on their homepage. It was so pristine. It was just like big product photography and a slogan.
Yeah.
And then when this deal came in, for like the first time in many, many, many years, there was a dollar figure on the homepage with an asterisk. So it wasn't just here's the dollar price. It was like here's the dollar and here's the catch.
Yeah.
And whilst the $449 is still on the site, which is the price you get when you trade an iPhone 7 Plus for an iPhone XR, the limited time banner, removing that makes it feel like 10 times more classy, because like you say, flashing limited time in your face is to me it feels like a car dealer tactic. It's like, don't leave the lot now, we'll give you 10% more off, limited time. It's like, come. And the whole point is, it's like pressuring your head, like, impulse buy, check out now, otherwise you're going to miss out. Like, and that just doesn't fit very well with the, you know, the premium Apple brand. Like, the fact they're doing discounts at all doesn't fit, but especially, you know, the high pressure, do it now, that kind of thing just doesn't fly. And obviously it was shown to be, you know, a sham, because they kept extending the limited time anyway.
Right.
So at least now they're being true to themselves, probably not because of any feeling of guilt, just the fact that they've now decided that they're going to keep this going until at least until the next iPhone, you know, like the iPhone 11 cycle.
Yeah.
So that's why it's gone now.
Yeah, and it used to say limited time, iPhone XR from $449, iPhone XS from $699, and there was the asterisk. And now it just says iPhone XR from $1,899 a month or $449, you know, asterisk. And they've removed the mention of the XS. It still applies. Like, you can still trade it in and get a boosted value for a XS or XS Max, but they're not advertising that way. And my thought on this is that probably – most people who are price sensitive and the trade-in program appeals to you, that you can give Apple your old iPhone and get a new iPhone at a discounted rate, those are probably XR customers. And if the XS price doesn't scare you at whether it's $700 or $1,000, you know, the trade-in program probably doesn't appeal to you. So by focusing on XR only here, you know, it narrows down the choices. And then it probably just is who that program is for, who's been working for anyway. And it kind of cleans up, like, it makes the XS a little bit more premium, because I think we all kind of felt like this ad, you know, this campaign makes the XR and XS feel like nobody wants them. And, you know, they're really trying to pressure people to upgrade iPhones. Like, people aren't impressed by these iPhones. And by leaving the XS out of it, it kind of makes it feel more like the premium phone that it is. You know, it is a very fancy phone. It can do things that the other phone can do, you know, a few things different, but not necessarily better. Like, it's about the materials in a lot of ways, and like the OLED screen and the stainless steel casing, but not necessarily, like, you know, that it can
raw functionality.
Right, exactly. Like, it's got the same chip. Max has two cameras, the XS has two cameras, but those are small things compared to, like, you know, the price differences, I think. So this kind of leaves the XS out of it and then focuses on the XR. It's like, everyone should upgrade to these phones. The other thing is that we mentioned this show before, like, at one point Apple did not mention battery life on the XR section of the homepage. And then they kept changing, like, that what the little, you know, three word sentences were.
Yeah, so I've got originally, when the XR was announced, right, through pre-orders all the way up until like October, the homepage had iPhone XR, brilliant in every way. That was it. Then it was learn more and buy.
Yeah.
And then after like a month, when clearly they started realizing, you know, people aren't getting the message, they changed it to the all-screen design, longest battery life ever, fast performance, studio quality photos, which is what's there today.
Yeah.
And then obviously after that, when the $449 offer came in, they added more text to support that deal, and then they changed it to make it like a separate section. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is easily the most amount of change that they've done for a phone. Like, this kind of spring refresh is just never heard of. Like,
right.
Because it even feels a bit like out of step, because the homepage is all white now, but then if you click through to the actual, like, XR or XS, like, product pages, they're still the black dark theme. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you just go to the iPhone page, and so not to the specific phone pages, but, like, to the massive iPhone page for all iPhones, they've now selected the longest battery life ever in an iPhone as the only line for the XR. So, like, on the homepage, you still got a collection of lines, but once you go to the iPhone page as a whole, it's iPhone XR, the longest battery life ever in an iPhone. So they've picked that as, like, what's working for selling iPhones. And then, and that's a used line. So it's already been available, but now that, you know, they're just using it exclusively on this page. On the XS section, I think that this is a new line, the ultimate iPhone in two sizes.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen the ultimate iPhone used elsewhere, but it's their way to say, you know, it's premium. It's the best iPhone you can get. So yeah, it's and this is, like, the kind of things that, you know, because we watch Apple every day, every year, we can see that this is not ordinary for Apple, but this does kind of fit what we would see for them. And it sounds like this is like what Tim Cook was talking about when he mentioned in the letter to investors about what Apple will do, to make it easier. When you actually go to buy an iPhone now, there's things like you can't even pick the model.
Capacity.
Yeah. Like you pick the 10R or 10S, but aside from that, you've got to then answer a question. Do you have an iPhone that you want to trade in? Yes or no. And that's totally new from what we can tell. That
yep. And on those yes and no buttons, it says right there and then, from $18.99 a month or $4.49.
Yeah.
From $31.99 a month or $7.49. Like the whole spiel in the letter to investors that Tim Cook did at the start of January, when they originally announced they were going to miss earnings, was we're going to make it easier for people to trade in their existing phone, finance the purchase of the new phone, and get help transferring the data across. And this like website redesign is holistically addresses those two points. Like, you cannot buy a phone anymore without knowing that you can buy it on a monthly plan and that you can trade in. Like, yeah. You cannot check out without asking the question, do you have a trade in?
Yeah.
To provide.
Yeah. And so you say trade in, yes or no, and then it's color, and then it's storage, and then it's carrier. I think it used to be in the mix, but it was like at the end, or it was just a separate section. And so now it's like the very first question is, you know, how high are we talking about this iPhone to be? We can get it down for you before we even discuss the color of it. And the other thing on the homepage that they've done is they changed the images that they show for the iPhones. So the 10S section used to just be, it was the gold iPhone on top of the bigger gold iPhone, you know, horizontally. And it hadn't changed since the images leaked, you know, and 95 Mac had the images. And then the 10R image was the front, I think it was like the front of a blue iPhone 10R, and then like the back of a black iPhone 10R and the back of a white iPhone 10R. So it really didn't do much just for the colors. And now it's like an array of iPhone 10Rs in every color, which like that's what sells these iPhones, is like their color in some way, like it's eye catching. And so it's amazing to me that they show white and black so much, when like the colors are what's interesting about them in many ways.
Yeah, I guess white and black must be really popular, but
yeah,
the colors are definitely the eye-catching thing. Like, to me, that is easy. If I had to pick one change of this like overnight refresh, the fact that the 10R, you can now actually see all the colors in like one go, is easily the best change. Like, the photography for before was, for a start, it only showed three of the colors at all, and two of them were really hidden, and two of them were the boring white and black ones. Like, at least now you get that full rainbow effect when you're looking at the spread, because the only one that's face up is the blue one, and then all the rest, they show the colors of their backs. It's just like much more punchy and much more, this is the colors. Because notice that in the text, they don't mention the colors at all.
Right.
Like, it's only the imagery where they, you know, they show off the rainbow effect. Like, whereas with the iPhone 5C, you know, they even played it off like the C stands for color almost. Like, they would say this iPhone's is for the colorful. That was the whole ad campaign.
Right.
With the 10R, they haven't really done that. Like, you had color flood for what that was worth. But like on the website as such, it doesn't really focus on the, you know, you can get these in five colors, as much as, you know, this is cheaper, this is the fastest performance, this is the longest battery life ever.
Yeah. And then on the 10S side, they're showing the angle was like the front of the top of the iPhones and like the side of the iPhone. So you got to see a little bit of the gold. Now you can see the back of the gold iPhone and the dual camera, which you couldn't see before. So, and I mean, those are things I think new gold, you know, the new gold back on the 10 style phone is new and interesting. And then the dual camera is like a big upgrade reason for people, I think. So, definitely like just better at doing the basics of like selling these iPhones. I think it's taken them many months from like the weird keynote where we were left like wondering what was even new about the new iPhones, to like now they say, you know, the 10S is the ultimate iPhone, which kind of like is like their go-to for every iPhone. It's the best one ever. But then for the 10R, you know, the best battery life, which is what the press, all the reviews, all the customers have been saying about it, that they appreciate the most. So now Apple's attaching themselves to that in a big way. So I think it's a good change. The other thing that they do now is they make it much clearer when you buy a new iPhone that you can pay with a carrier, or you can pay full price, or you can pay with the iPhone upgrade program, or now it's clearer than ever that you can just pay with payments without doing the upgrade program. And I guess the difference is there, like, it's the end price is a little bit different, because with the upgrade program, you have to have AppleCare. And the idea is that you trade in your iPhone the next year, and then you just stay on a train, like, you keep upgrading annually. But the way that they're marketing now with just iPhone payments as an option is that you get a loan from Apple for 24 months, or the bank that Apple uses, for 2 years, but then there's no pressure to upgrade the next year and to trade in every year. It's just this year we want you to buy a new iPhone, and we'll figure out
the there's no later. Obligation. It's just a 0% interest loan, essentially.
Right. And with the iPhone upgrade program, like, you could just pay off the phone and keep it too as an option. Like, that's always an option, but it's not the intent of the program. And so this is, you know, it's clearer than ever now that that's an option at checkout. So they've definitely, like, overhauled how they present the iPhones and how you buy them at checkout on Apple's website. So, which probably matches, like, catching up with what retail's been doing in person for, you know, a few weeks at least.
I think it's a really interesting, like, overall message of how Apple kind of, like, fumbled the cycle with, like, if they'd got it right, this wouldn't have changed so much. And
sure.
This has gone through, you know, 3 or 4 significant redesigns on the website. And I think those redesigns on the website also mirror changes in their own marketing strategy. Like, on the iPhone XR, like, TV ads, they make the battery life thing really prominent now. They even do quotes from publications in the TV ads. Like, I saw an iPhone XR ad just before Christmas where it, like, quoted The Verge in the opening thing, like, the ultimate iPhone for everyone or something. It was some, you know, catchphrase like that. And it just shows that they've, you know, really had to revamp their thinking and kind of go back to the drawing board a bit, because their original pitch of brilliant in every color, you know, that the original attempt just clearly didn't convey what they needed to. And even with the redesign now, I'm sure the sales aren't going to, like, jump back up to, you know, millions and millions higher.
Right.
But it's just kind of clarifying the messaging, and presumably they are then sending these kind of changes to the front-facing pages are also the kind of changes they make to, like, training documents for, like, Apple retail employees to sell stuff. Like, it all kind of flows down and bubbles down from the top.
Yeah. All right, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about foldable phones, because that's also part of this conversation, is that, you know, people looking at what Apple's doing with their iPhones and their admittedly tough quarter for iPhone upgrades. Not that iPhone sales are bad, but that upgrades are down. And so that's growth, and that's what investors care about. People are also looking at Samsung doing the Galaxy Fold last week, and Huawei has a foldable iPhone too. One folds, I guess, and one folds out, so it's different approaches. But these are actually shipping products that you'll be able to buy and purchase. So there's some interesting, like, thinking about, is Apple being severely out-innovated in his, like, foldable displays? Is that what Apple should be doing, and that the reason that they're struggling is because they're stuck with these old traditional phones now? And the thing for me, like, my take on all this is that Samsung at their event showed the Galaxy Fold for nearly $2,000. I think the price was, like, $1,980. So they managed to save $20 off the $2,000 price. You know, it's neat. It's interesting. It's got, you know, obvious flaws, but it is a shipping product for a very expensive amount of money. But it's not that Apple said, or that Samsung said, this is the new Galaxy S10 and it's the foldable phone. They also have a whole Galaxy S10 phone that they're shipping for, like, the regular prices. And it's almost
including,
like,
one that is literally $750 directly competing against the iPhone XR.
Right. So I think that's a very tough compare to say, like, Samsung's got, like, their hobby, their neat, it's neat tech, but it's not consumer level yet in terms of price or even, like, how polished it is yet. It's like they're releasing R&D as a product that you can buy if you're very enthusiastic about that. But they've also got to keep doing the S10, you know, normal phone business, because if they didn't, then that would be very bad. And, like, the closest thing I can think of to that is, like, when Apple did the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10. but then, you know, the next year, it's like the iPhone 10 very much influenced what the next version of the iPhone 8 was going to be. And it was even, like, a mix in price of the 8 and 8 Plus. And it's not like $1,000 isn't $2,000. So,
The price differential was a lot closer between the 8 and the 10. Like,
yeah. And,
but, the way the Galaxy Fold almost is like Apple Watch Edition level, like the Gold Edition, where it's so exclusive, is it's more like a trophy product. Like, yes, we did this first, rather than, you know, we actually want to sell this to millions and millions of people this year. Like, I have no doubt that eventually foldable devices would be very, very popular. It's just the first, you know, the initial crop are just kind of more like, hey, we did it, not, you know, this is actually practical for people to buy realistically. Like, I'm pretty sure half the reason they're so expensive is just because yields are so bad that they have to keep the price high to even manage it.
Yeah, and it's, I don't think it's the equivalent of, like, whenever Apple got caught, you know, years behind on making large screen phones, you know. Like, Samsung was definitely first, you know, they beat Apple by years for, you know, what we called phablets at the time, just phones with very big screens. And when they did make larger phones, you know, I would argue that, like, Samsung made better big screen phones in terms of, like, how you hold them in your hand and, like, size than Apple did, because they took the small phone and just, like, expanded it. And then you had, like, a lot of tin and bezel. It took a long time to remedy that. But yeah, the thing is, I think it's more fair to compare, like, the 10R and the 10S against the S10, which is, like, a normally priced phone with normal features. And it does have features that the iPhone doesn't have yet, but many are rumored for the iPhone 11, like the fact that you can, you know, charge something on the back of it. You've got wireless input charging, but you'll also have wireless output charging. That's an S10 feature for their watch and their earbuds and then other phones. And the rumor is, you know, from Ming-Chi Kuo, that Apple will add that as well. And we assume, at least for AirPods, that it will work with AirPods wireless charging case. Maybe I don't know if it'll work with the watch or not, or their phones or not. But, like, the foldable thing is just, like, I mean, there are all it's just, it's really like a shipping prototype, like, that you can pay a lot of money to have access to early. And
yeah, I don't think it's a 1.0. It's like a 0.5 right. In terms of where they are. Imagine for a second, right, that Apple did the Galaxy Fold, but it ran iOS, right? And it was, even if it was $1,500, I don't think that it would be that popular. It just, like, the problem with the Galaxy Fold is you're making a foldable phone which can fit in your pocket to try and maximize screen space. But in the unfolded version, it's 7.3 inches, which is still smaller than, like, an iPad mini. So it's not really a tablet screen. And when it's folded up, there are massive bezels on the top and bottom, and it's really thick. And the second screen, the normal quote unquote phone screen, is 4.3 inches. So that's way smaller than the current, you know, status quo phones. So you're kind of compromising on your, you know, your pull out experience just for the unfolding, you know, feature. But then you're unfolding to a screen that's not that much bigger than, you know, the big phablets are today that fit in your pocket fine. Like, an iPhone XS Max is, what, 6.5 inches? This is 7.3. It's not, you know, it's not miles apart. Like, if you could unfold something to go from, to go up to, like, a 10 to 10 inches, you know, like a proper tablet, then maybe that'd be different.
Mm-hmm.
But the compromise you have on the Galaxy Fold, where it's so thick and you literally have bezels that are bigger than the original iPhone when it's folded up, it just feels untenable. The Huawei Mate 10 is more futuristic. Like, that actually looks good. and they don't have two screens. They just have, because that's the one that folds outwards. So it lights up half the screen, and when you unfold it, it lights up the other half as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that one has, you know, normal, modern size bezels. Like, they're not the thinnest in the world, but they're pretty thin. And that unfolds to a similar 7.5 inches, but, you know, you're not having ridiculous borders. The problem there is that these screens are all plastic, because you can't have bendable glass currently, so all the screens are plastic. And if it's outward facing, you know, plastic scratches pretty easily, and you probably can't put a case on it, so you're probably going to end up with a pretty scratched screen all over the place. And you have to worry about whether that actual bit where it bends is going to start creasing, whether you can see the crease under certain lighting, because on some of the photos people have taken, you can definitely see a crease down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you can see that in, you know, like, in hands-on, you know, normal usage is yet to be seen, but that one isn't. That one's even more expensive. That one's like $2,500, and it's like, it's cool. Like, I'm not gonna deny it's not interesting, but it doesn't feel like mainstream appeal yet, especially at the price point. But even if it was a bit cheaper, I still think people wouldn't buy onto it. Like, I would rather, you know, buy $900 iPhones plus an iPad, like, versus that in its current form. Maybe when they can, you know, be thinner, the battery life situation's unclear. Like, it's when it gets further down the road, of course it's gonna be useful. And obviously the question is, how long is that going to take? Because they're not terrible, but they're not ready. But you can imagine in, like, two more years that maybe the, you know, the foldables are actually to the point where they are shippable and good. And by that point, will Apple have something? We don't know yet.
Yeah, I just struggle to think of in the timeline of the iPhone, this happening where there's like a concept that you can buy and people thinking like, you know, looking at that as like Apple's been beaten in terms of like what the current options are. Because I think that like with the, you know, whenever big screen phones came out, you could still buy some small screen Android phones, but they weren't like, once big screen phones came out, like those were what you got, and it replaced the small screen phones in a big way. And we only got bigger and bigger phones. Like the early big screen phones were pretty bad. Like, I think it was the, HTC Thunderbolt was one of them that was like really bad battery life, but it had LTE. So there were some rocky ones, but it wasn't that like, here's the serious product and here's the concept thing that like enthusiasts maybe will experiment with. I don't know. So it's weird. Conceptually, though, I am also interested in like the idea of like foldable displays if the plastic isn't too big of a compromise for like how it looks, you know, viewing content, and if the crease isn't a problem over time, like how many folds is it guaranteed for before it becomes a problem? But I like the idea of it as like something that makes your tablet more portable, where you know you've got a much bigger screen and you can fold it, you know, once over, twice over, or so, and make it much more, you know, pocket friendly. Because for me, that's like the phone goes everywhere no matter what. And, you know, you can fit a lot of content on it. And then you've got to go to a much bigger scale for you to be able to fit like way more on it to make a difference. And so the tablet, though, ends up being left behind often if you've just got to rely like on your hands and your pockets and not like another bag or something. But if like the iPad becomes like pocketable, then you could see, you know, where like watch plus iPad is like, you know, meets all your needs, you know, if that were allowed, where you've got your iPad in your pocket, and your watch in your wrist, and you can talk to Siri and send messages like with your voice. But if you want like a bigger access to the internet and everything and apps, then you pull out your iPad and unfold it and do that. But yeah, I hope they keep innovating, like, you know, keep turning over, like evolving what they're showing. But I agree, it isn't 1.0 yet. And it's okay to be excited for it too. Like, you know, if you wanted to buy it, like the market is luxury. And I think that's a little off. I think it's just like, here's an R&D project that you can pay us to support and try out yourself. I don't imagine that like this, you know, this has the potential to change fast, I guess, if it actually improves. Or, I mean, it very quite possibly could just like never take off in the next like 5 years or so if it doesn't improve. If this is like what we have for the next, you know, however many years, then I don't think this is it yet.
Yeah, like the S10 is fierce competition to the to the iPhone line. Yes. And I feel like at the moment we're in a more diversified smartphone space than ever. Like you've got the weird foldables at the high end. You've got, you know, a plethora of cheap models from like OnePlus and Huawei. And then even in the premium lines, you've got like Samsung doing, you know, different stuff with the kind of corner cut out, not rather than a notch. Mm-hmm. They've chosen to go to the optical fingerprint under the screen root, yep, versus, you know, like a Face ID sensor. So like, you know, Apple's all in on the, you know, notch cut out, but you can get higher screen to body ratios on the S10. A big reason of that is the fact that it has an on-display fingerprint sensor and doesn't have to have space for, you know, the 3D infrared camera stuff. So it's like,
right.
Yeah, and I like Face ID, but there are plenty of people that, you know, don't like it. So there's, and maybe if you like were on iPhone 10 and you just get so annoyed that you wake up in the morning and your face can't detect you, and you're like, well, this Samsung phone will just go back to the fingerprint that I know and love. Like, I continue to, you know, peddle the notion that a future iPhone should have both Face ID and Touch ID like under the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we get that is, who knows, but it's like the Face ID thing still annoys me when it's off angle and it's just like the camera's never going to see me this angle.
Yeah. Do you use a 4 or 6-digit passcode?
I use a 4-digit passcode.
Yeah, me too, because I still use it enough that if I had to use a 6-digit passcode every time that Face ID didn't work for whatever reason, it would be annoying.
Yeah. Like I feel like if I could go to 6 digits, then it be like Face ID is a success.
Yeah, that's
like
that's
a true success,
right?
Because Face ID kind of has like, when it works perfectly, it's better than what Touch ID ever was before, because it just feels way more magical. Like, you just looked at your phone and you've just done it.
Yeah, it's less friction.
But,
yeah.
But there's more variance to it. Like, I feel like Touch ID was more consistent in you could do this and it would work more often. Whereas Face ID has, like, plenty of situations where it's just never going to work, you know, realistically ever. Like, you're just at weird angles, or, you know, you've got a completely different... Like, I feel like the waking up in the morning thing is a real issue, especially with people that have bad eyesight, so they bring their phone really close to their face in the morning, and that's not the appropriate distance for the Face ID sensors to work. Like, we heard about the rumors of Minchi Kuo saying a higher-powered flood illuminator, which will help with the kind of IR interference from the sun, but I don't know if that's going to help. I kind of want them to also announce... It also works at more ranges of distance. Like, you can be closer to the phone and it can still work at your face. Because I feel like it's a big point of friction. And all of the Android manufacturers are seemingly steering clear of it and just going down the fingerprint route.
Yeah, it still feels like the iPad Pro definitely has a better Face ID experience too. And it's that at different angles, the iPad seems to be more... it's okay. Like, you can unlock your face, whereas the iPhone... wants you to be, like, in a very specific position. And part of it for me is that, like, my vision just is not great anyway. Like, I wear glasses, and with glasses, it's, like, the best I can do, but it's not perfect. And so my phone is closer to my face than it often wants to be. And for the iPad, it's very big, so I can hold it further away, whereas, like, Face ID distance needs to be. But the angle thing still gets me. It's like they say it's the same exact hardware inside, but I don't know. it's definitely it feels true that the iPad unlocks with Face ID much more often than the iPhone does. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's like if Apple wants to resolve the iPhone sales, like I don't know that like a foldable prototype would do anything.
Before the foldable things happened, right, with the Samsung event,
yeah,
everyone was complaining. Nobody wants to buy the new iPhones because they're too expensive.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And then this foldable event happens, everyone gets caught up in the hype, like, oh, the foldables are the future. Apple doesn't have a foldable. They're doomed. And it's like, you know, the foldables are not cheap. Like, the number one problem, the pricing is an issue. I completely understand that. Like, these phones are very expensive and there is way more hesitancy to upgrade when the prices go up, like, no doubt. But the foldables are not the answer to that for a long, long time. Like, they just need more compelling... you know, phones at the lower end, and that includes messaging, like we talked about before the break, and that includes functionality. And so far, the iPhone 11 cycle is not, you know, piquing my interest that much. It's like,
that's true.
It's an unclear future.
This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Upstart. Applying for a loan is a lot like applying for a job that you don't get to interview for. Instead, loan companies make their decisions based off your credit score and history without getting to know the whole you. Now, thanks to Upstart.com, it never has to be that way again. Upstart is revolutionizing the way you borrow money by rewarding you for your job experience and education in the form of a smarter interest rate. When you're young and just starting out on your own for the first time, or even if you've just never established a credit history before, it can feel daunting to overcome that. I've been there in college. That's where Upstart can help. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. Unlike traditional credit underwriting, which could be biased against people with a short credit history, Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate in less than 2 minutes without affecting your credit score. The best part? Once your loan is approved, the funds will be transferred to you the very next business day. The next day. Over 100,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or even just make a large purchase. So don't wait. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. Hurry to upstart.com/happyhour to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/happyhour. Our thanks to Upstart for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, the other thing this week is a story that you covered from the Wall Street Journal this week about Apple potentially launching a new credit card this year. I think it might have been me that covered their coverage last year of this story, but this time they've got many more details at least. So I just looked back. It was May 2018 that we covered the story of Apple partnering with Goldman Sachs to introduce Apple Pay credit card in early 2019. So now early 2019 is here, and the Wall Street Journal has more details, even though it hasn't been announced yet. So tell me what's new here with this story.
Yeah, so they say in terms of timing, it will be launching later in the year, but it's going to be deployed to Apple and Goldman Sachs employees for testing shortly.
So the idea of testing a credit card, what do you do? Like, it either works or doesn't work. I guess it's the other details of like how it works. But that detail, like that was weird to me. Testing it internally.
I mean, everything has to be tested, yeah, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, it's like you can have even the boring dongles have to be tested to some extent. Like, yeah. And the whole point here is that this is more than just a boring credit card. It can also, like, the idea is there's going to be deep integration into the wallet app on the iPhone, mm-hmm. which will be able to tell you stuff like your balance, upcoming purchases, your transaction history. And as also they say they are pondering ideas which kind of correlate to the rings on the activity app for the watch. So you'd be able to see, like, this is how much you spend on average, or this is how much you want to spend in a month, and here's your progress towards that. Maybe the iPhone could alert you if you've overspent on groceries, for instance. You know, if you're 2 weeks in and you spent twice as much on groceries than you normally do, then maybe it'll give you a little alert saying, yeah, you know, be careful.
Those aren't like brand new features to like what a credit card could do or a bank could do, but it would be new if it's part of the wallet app. And if you only got them from the Apple Pay credit card, which is backed by Goldman Sachs. So it's we've seen in iOS 12.2 beta like pretty significant design changes in iOS in the wallet app. Not that you can do things different, but that the way it's presented, it's much easier to do. So there's like an info panel where you can look at a card and then see like transaction history if it's Apple Pay Cash, or contact your bank, or open like the cards, the bank's app on the iPhone to see much more information. And it sounds like maybe it's all related that Apple's putting work into how it looks, because, you know, pretty soon, at least for one credit card from Apple, there'll be much more that you can do in that section. Which
kind yeah, of and I think when we covered iOS 12.2 beta in the podcast like 2 weeks ago, and we mentioned the visual changes, which are, you know, quite significant. Like there's no new features, but they have like the new styles of table cells, and they have those cool animations, like the different transitions. I think I said on the show, like, it's rare for Apple to revamp the look of an application and then not have anything associated with it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And then, you know, two episodes later, oh, it's because the credit card's coming out soon. Like, that's why they're investing in it all of a sudden. Because generally, the stock Apple apps don't change unless they have, you know, new features going on. It's rare to see out of the blue design changes on pretty much anything. Like, in recent times, the only thing that springs to mind is like the FaceTime change, where they brought the flip camera button to a sane location, but that was just because there was so much outcry about it. Yeah. Like, in general, that doesn't happen,
right?
And which is kind of why so many people want, you know, like a comprehensive system redesign, kind of like the iOS 7 era, but done properly. And it feels like we're getting maybe some of that this year, maybe not. It's still unclear, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
But clearly in this case, this iOS 12.2 stuff is signaling, oh, they are working on behind the scenes a more major like dashboard for your credit cards. And it could be that the Apple Goldman Sachs card is just like the first run at it, because presumably it will be US only, and then they'll do partnerships with overseas places to kind of spread it out. Because you are right, like stuff like spending goals and tracking that, the things that like my bank can do for as well for me. I just turn it all off because I'm not interested in it. Right. But it's not like, it's not brand new ideas necessarily. It's, you know, the integration of doing it in the same app where you can also do that stuff. Because I could imagine like when you go to the checkout and you put your phone on the card and it lights up automatically with the wallet and you're on the Goldman Sachs card, it could tell you like, here's your applicable rewards for this purchase. Because as well as the kind of, you know, financial targeting stuff, they also say that they're targeting giving away 2% cash back on all purchases. And then for if you're buying an Apple device, you could maybe get, you know, a few more percentage points back. So maybe when you check out, it could show, like the iPhone could tell you, oh, you're getting 2% back here, which is something that you that kind of information you can't see with other cards, like, because the offers aren't integrated into the actual UI.
Yeah, and we mentioned this a year ago in our coverage of the first round of this story, which is that Apple and Barclays Bank have an Apple Rewards credit card that you can apply for and finance Apple's or purchases and then use anywhere as a Barclay card, as a credit card. And it has cashback rewards and through a point system. And you get more of those points if it's an Apple purchase, whether it's like iTunes, the App Store, or the Apple Store. And they give you, you know, email marketing for Apple products, and it works with Apple Pay. So it's like the only thing it doesn't really do is like deeper integration with the wallet app for things that don't exist yet that are possibly coming. You know, showing you not in the Barclays app, but in Apple's wallet app. You know, how much you've spent and how much you have left, and maybe nicer ways to manage all that. But there was like weird pushback from people. I get that Goldman Sachs has a bad name for like a decade ago behavior and this big history in the U.S. economy. But the idea of Apple doing a credit card is like part of a service business for revenue. Maybe there's a bigger split here with like what they'll get from all this than the existing Barclays deal. But it just felt to me that like they've done the Barclays thing for a long time, and this is, you know, a new version of that, but not something totally different. Because like there was reaction to this from people that comment on Apple things that was just like, thought it would be insane for Apple to have a credit card, like, you know. And then also the usual, like, Apple's making, they're one step closer to having a bank. And I'm not sure, like, how this is different. Like, what makes this different than the Barclays thing? And I haven't seen anything that says, aside from, like, the deeper integration with new features in the wallet app, that there's anything different here than that, except that it's just the next take on that, you know, with a different bank behind it.
Yeah, the journal article even discusses, like, banking type features, but it says that Apple stepped away from that on privacy concerns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at least for now, then they're not going that far.
Yeah.
The problem is a lot of this is a very vague description until we see it. Like, it's hard to fully nail down, because you're right. Like, it basically is like the Apple Rewards card, but instead of points, you get cash back. And instead of those points happening, you know, after the fact on the bank statement, it's directly integrated into the wallet app itself. I'm presuming there will be Apple Pay Cash connections to this card, because right now Apple Pay Cash is done through like a Discover card, through like Green Bank or Green Point or whatever they're called.
Yeah, Green Bank.
And this is going to be a MasterCard based card, and presumably they will take over the responsibilities of Apple Pay Cash with this. Like, I don't know.
I would think that the more likely thing is that they have no integration, and that even though they're both like Apple Pay marketed, that because of what it is behind the scenes, that it's a different thing. Like, holding someone's money with what Green Dot does versus the credit business, it feels like just different. And so that there wouldn't be the crossover, and there wouldn't be a replacement for like Green Dot. So
yeah, I get the feeling there'll be more Goldman Sachs partnerships than just the card, because part of the intro to the Wall Street Journal article is that in 2017 Apple executives were frustrated about how their financing situation was so fragmented, where they use like Citizen One to give you 0%, and then in a different country they give you a different bank, and then in the UK it's Barclays, and then they have the Apple Rewards card. And it sounded like they were shopping around to try and find a more comprehensive solution by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe their ambitions got cut short, but it kind of feels like they want this partnership with Goldman Sachs to be more fundamental. Like, they're going to be, because the Apple Rewards card is going to stop, the Barclays card is going to stop when this one comes out, for instance. So I think there will be more around this than just the credit card, like more than just the US only credit card.
Yep. All right. Another interesting Apple Store related story this week is reported from Michael Stieber, which is that in Texas, Plano and Frisco, two physical, real, actual Apple stores will close in April, I believe. And there's a new store opening in Galleria, Dallas. So it's going to be one store to replace two other stores, but they're not exactly like across the street. And what Michael discovered in looking at this story is that the reason for it is probably that in the district that the two Apple stores that are closing, the district that they're in, is in East Texas, is notorious for the judge in that district listening to cases against Apple from companies that people would accuse of being patent trolls and things that – so and so it's like companies will use that judge to sue Apple. So they'll sue in that district because they know that judge will listen to their case, and then they'll often win, and Apple will be forced to do weird stuff with like FaceTime and other things. And that Apple believes that there's an argument to be made that if there's no headquarters in that district and there's no like a retail store, for example, they've got no brick and mortar operation in that district of Texas, then that court isn't applicable anymore. So it will no longer be a problem. You know, that judge's preference for listening to so-called patent trolls' arguments against Apple and then them eventually winning, that the whole problem goes away by them not having Apple stores in that district. And it isn't like they'll come back if, you know, eventually, like it seems like they're making the decision. They're not saying it. They're saying that the stores are closing and that there's one new one to replace it. But it seems to be that there's no other explanation than that. And they've closed stores in the past before. I think there was one in New Jersey last year that they closed, not because they were like renovating it for a bigger store, but because I think it was in New Jersey, and they said that the tourism business in that area had just swindled, and so that their store just didn't have as much foot traffic as they needed to have a store. In this case, there was no reason given. It was just, you know, one new store coming, these two are going away. We'll help people work at the new store if they want to. And it's just crazy that, like, it's a pretty remarkable thing. Like Apple's retail business, I guess, especially in, you know, this part of Texas, like, isn't so important that they could just like close retail entirely in that, you know, area of the state and not have a replacement. But to think of like the behind the scenes idea that because of legal problems, like because of people suing over patents and one judge in that district who isn't going anywhere anytime soon, that the solution to that might be to literally close two businesses down and move them a few miles away from where the district is so that you can still drive there to be a customer, but it's not going to be in that, you know, legal district at least.
Yeah. This story is like, it blows my mind that this actually makes a difference on, you know, patent liability. Like,
or at least might, right?
Yeah. Like, the patent system is crazy enough as it is. But this particular detail, that the presence of physical locations, you know, impacting your ability to get sued, is like nonsensical to me. Because, like, you know, if you take the stores away, Apple's still going to sell to people in Texas online or through third-party retailers and stuff. Like, they're not saying we're not going to sell phones to Texas anymore. So I tweeted, like, can this really be true? And a few people said back that it helps them defend against it, but it's not like a silver bullet. Like, it's not, they're not unattackable anymore, but it probably does help because they can show that there's not meaningful business in the region, which is mad to me because, like, you know, half the state's going to use an iPhone anyway. But if you think about it, if you look at some of the patent suits that Apple has lost in the last like 5 years, those figures probably do outweigh the amount of revenue that these two, you know, small Texas mall stores brought in. Like, the Vernet cases where it's like FaceTime patent suits, Apple keeps losing them, and they're like $400 million, $300 million, you know, penalties a pop each time round, and you only need a few of them, and you're like, an individual Apple store is probably not going to outweigh that. And you're right that there have only been like a very small number of Apple stores that have truly closed before, like not replaced by anything.
Right.
Like probably around 10 total since they began. And here's two that are closing, not because of, you know, economic environment, just because of some weird patent technicality. And it's like, wow, that is mad.
Yeah. You can read Michael Sieber's very detailed report about it, in which he, you know, makes a discovery and then lays out the case for what's happening. And I think in one of the cases, one of the stores was like just a few years old. So it's not like these are like super old stores. These were modern stores. So yeah, read the story. It's super interesting. I know it made the rounds, and you know, it's neat. So it's, I don't think Apple will ever say on the record, yeah, we close our stores because, you know, that's not going to help their case. But we will probably see them argue, you can't sue us in this district anymore. We don't have business here at all, you know. So it's a wild one. This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Ridge Wallet. Visit ridgewallet.com/Mac to learn more. The Ridge is a minimalist front pocket wallet that helps you reevaluate your everyday carry. Launched by a father-son team and funded on Kickstarter in 2013, the Ridge now resides in the pockets of over 250,000 men and women. The RFID blocking wallet is made by two metal plates, either titanium, carbon fiber, or aluminum, bounded together by a durable elastic band. At a glance, the Ridge looks nothing like a traditional wallet. The sleek metal plates are only about the size of a credit card, and the elastic band keeps the Ridge neat and tidy, so it never feels bulky in your pocket. I tested my Ridge wallet with 6 cards: my debit card, credit card, a gift card, gym card, driver's license, and the Ridge instructional card, and they fit great. A secure metal clip also holds your cash in place. The Ridge wallet isn't just meant to be a sleek and modern wallet replacement, although it is that. It also helps you focus on what you carry. No more needing to clean out months of old receipts and all the other junk that just accumulates in traditional wallets. We shouldn't treat our wallets like suitcases, and they shouldn't look like suitcases either. I especially like how the Ridge wallet is designed around the dimensions of a credit card, the modern-day payment method, and the military-grade materials mean the Ridge wallet is backed by a lifetime guarantee. 9to5 Mac Happy Hour listeners can get 10% off today with free worldwide shipping by going to ridgewallet.com/Mac. That's ridgewallet.com/MAC. And use code MAC10 at checkout. That's MAC10 at checkout. Our thanks to The Ridge for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, the last thing we'll talk about this week is the Apple Watch. There was a new report from our pal Mark Gurman at Bloomberg about a new feature in a future Apple Watch. So tell me about that report.
Correct. So Gurman this week said that by 2020, Apple is aiming to release native sleep tracking features to the watch. And the way it is posed in the article is that this would be exclusive to new hardware. It doesn't preclude them adding, you know, sleep tracking functionality to the software, but the story specifically is about they want to roll out differences in the hardware by 2020, and obviously the watches get refreshed in the fall, so it'll be late 2020, that support sleep tracking features first party. This is obviously a big area where there are a lot of third-party apps already that do a decent job at filling in the gaps, but Apple doesn't really have anything themselves. The best you kind of get is the bedtime clock alarm on the iPhone, which just approximates based on the time that the alarm's set for and whether you're using your iPhone at all during that period, and then puts that data into the health app as, you know, sleep and not asleep. But clearly something like built into the watch would be far more accurate and far more relevant. Competitors to the Apple Watch, like Fitbit, are a huge, you know, they're probably the number two wearable manufacturer, and they have sleep tracking on all their devices, so it's a very big competitive disadvantage there at the moment. And my family, like my dad, loves his Apple Watch, but he would love to use it for sleep tracking, and I've told him about the third-party apps, but it just doesn't quite feel the same. He was just confused. He's like, why doesn't Apple do this? I was like, I don't know, they just haven't got around to it yet. And them even doing it by full 2020 kind of feels like sleeping on the job, to use the pun, because it's so late compared to, like, the watch came out in, what, 2015? And so that'd be like six generations.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the story for me, was that you know, Mark's story is that they're planning sleep tracking for a future watch probably next year. But it also tells us that by this year, there will not be sleep tracking in the Apple Watch Series 5, which could be reasonable expectation for maybe just like watch OS 6, and like, you know, it's a feature that all watches can do now because you can do sleep tracking through apps on any watch anyway, and that there's a version of it on, like, say, the Fitbit, or even like the Pebble eventually added sleep tracking, I think. Like, you know, there were very basic bands that just like take movement and heart rate, if even using heart rate to determine sleep quality. And so whenever they deliver, because they've taken so long, it seems that they'll need to, you know, have some pretty good reasons for, like, this is why the quality is what it, you know, why it's better than what they're doing. You know, because, like, the apps that you can use now, they, I think it's like for your dad's case, for example, even though it's not the Apple Watch doing it itself, like it's not Apple doing it, it goes into Apple's health app alongside like all the data that the watch itself collects with like steps of movement. And it can be pretty detailed. Like I think they've got like asleep and then bed. Mm-hmm. And then within their apps themselves, it can be like much more detailed. But if you just want to know like, were you only in bed trying to fall asleep and then you were actually asleep, it will tell you, you know, and so I wonder, like, what Apple will do, and if it's that they just – it seems to me that maybe the challenge would be charging, and they just want to have, like, much better battery life. And it's not that the battery life lasts longer, but that it just charged faster, that you want to go from 20 to 100 super fast and not just, like, at the kind of slow pace that you get now, because people are already doing that with apps like Auto Sleep, and I think Sleep Plus Plus is another one, where you can sleep with the watch on, but then you've got to figure out when you're going to charge it in the day. Like, if you're in the shower or driving, you're just not wearing your watch for, like, an hour here and an hour there. And it depends. Like, if you only use 30% of your watch battery, you can charge much faster. But if you use 90% of your watch battery, it will take you three times as long to charge. So, you know, I wonder if that's the challenge, is to just that, you know, a bigger battery so that you don't worry about the capacity at all, you know, just more power efficiency, or if it's, you know, a faster version of the Apple Watch charger that then allows you to, you know, take a 15-20 minute shower and the watch goes from 30 to 100 like super fast. And that doesn't seem, you know, without a wired connection, it doesn't seem possible. You know,
to go that quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, like, Apple's recommendation is you charge it overnight, but there are plenty of people that do wear their watch to bed today, even if they're not using an app. That's just how they, you know, their previous watches, they just wear their watch to sleep and they carry it on now. I'm pretty sure that's what my dad does. He just wakes up in the morning and while he's having breakfast and goes in the shower, he puts the watch on to charge and it suits him perfectly fine. But it's like, you can't, like, the Auto Sleep is really impressive. Like, it has Apple Watch style rings. It can do it in the background. It can give you little alerts. But it's such a fundamental, like, primitive feature. It shouldn't be something that you're at the behest of a third-party developer to find. Yeah. Because, A, you have to pay for it. B, the pricing could change. Maybe they go to a subscription, because Apple wants to move developers to subscriptions. And it could go away anytime. And it's like, you know, and it's on that kind of cusp where it's like, maybe Apple will reject it one day and it'll never return. Like, it's one of those features where it needs to be built in. Yeah. So, and there probably is unique stuff that Apple can do, at least at a software level, if they're making themselves. For instance, they could put the watch into like a special sleep mode overnight where it's lower power, so it drains less battery, because all it's doing is tracking your sleep patterns. Maybe through an accelerometer.
Any kind of sleep tracking, where you guys say like start sleep tracking now and then end it here, is a no-go for me. But if it detected automatically, like the thing for me is, if you sleep with a watch now and you have the low heart rate alerts on, you might wake up to, I don't know, like 20 or 30 low heart rate alerts, because it knows your heart rate has gone so low. And that's like, to me, enough to say, oh, you're sleeping now, you know, because if you get like 20 or 30, it's like, oh, it isn't normal, you know. This is an extended period of time, because like what that's for, I think, is your heart rate has dropped and it's rare. But if it drops every night or, you know, every day at a certain period of time for hours at a time and doesn't go back up until, you know, later, then that's probably enough data to say, oh, sleep. I don't know how the third party sleep tracking apps are working now. The ones that do it automatically, but like, ideally, like what the watch would do is, oh, you're sleeping now, and then turn off a lot of functionality. And the best way to do it with the watch now is to use theater mode, so the screen won't come on, you won't get alerts, you won't get sounds, you can get taps, but you can turn on Do Not Disturb too. And that way, the watch is like it's in sleep mode. And you know, the best way to do it now that way is to have one watch for sleep mode, like an older version that's always in theater mode. And so you just put it on physically, and that's kind of the start and stop. It's like you take off your watch to charge it, you put on the new watch to wind down for bed, and you know, it doesn't disturb you. And maybe in this case, like, just it detects your heart rate goes down, and so it puts your watch into that mode and then turns off all kind of like fetch functionality where it doesn't even receive the data, you know, from like messages and email and all that stuff. And then definitely doesn't give you the low heart rate alerts, you know, in the morning. But yeah, and then in 2017 they bought Bedit, the company that puts a pad under your mattress, like a strip. And then the idea is, as long as you sleep in the same place every night, so, you know, your bed at home, then you can track your sleep that way. And I tried the second version of this, and you still needed to do some start-stop stuff to it. You could do, like, auto-detect, but it needed access to your microphone. It's kind of weird. I didn't like it. And if you, like, used your iPhone for like white noise or like to play a podcast, because the microphone was needed to be active at that time, it would like lower the volume of the audio output because it was also listening too. And it was just, I found it not to be great at all. And I didn't keep using it like beyond the testing phase.
And even after Apple bought it, that's still how it works today. Like they did a revised version at the end of 2018, but mm-hmm. it still relies on like microphone stuff.
Yeah, and they have a watch app too, which I think is like marketed for like naps in between when you're not awake, you're not in your bed. But I don't like that idea. Like, you know, I think sleep tracking with the watch will work independent of hardware, independent of the iPhone, and independent of like where you're sleeping. Because that seems like what it ought to do, and so it's what the third.
Yeah, I mean, like the Apple Watch can detect falls with its gyroscope and stuff, and accelerometer. It can definitely detect you not moving and lying down, mm-hmm. like. And go into a sleep mode automatically. And that is the kind of stuff that a third-party app couldn't do. Even with that all being said, I feel like Apple's still going to need some kind of like special source, cool feature to kind of justify the fact that it's taken them so long, especially if it's hardware limited. Like I could kind of see them doing it, which kind of goes against like exactly what Mark says. But what if they did it as a software feature in like WatchOS 6 or WatchOS 7, but then kind of like double down of it being, you know, maybe it's off by default on current watches, but then if you get the new watch, it has better battery life and it can charge faster. So it's on by default, and it's kind of marketed more with the first watch. It does seem kind of, you know, like punitive not to enable that kind of thing for everybody, even in like a limited form. Like maybe there'd be some special stuff that the new watch can do the others can't, but not doing it at all when they're facing a market that, you know, offers it across the board and they'd still sell last year's watch anyway. Like, I feel like sleep tracking is a big draw for people and probably a big turnoff as to why people don't jump on board. Like, oh, it doesn't do sleep tracking, I'll just stick to my Fitbit. Like, why do I need an Apple Watch?
Yeah, I will say that anytime we write about sleep tracking with the watch on 95 Mac, the stories are really popular. Like it seems to be kind of... There's a few things that like you might see like coverage of in lots of places, like cord cutting, sleep tracking, you know, probably some more things. But like those, for some reason... have great appeal to people, like maybe like a wider audience than normal. I think it's like problems that people haven't cracked yet, but like, you know, solve, but they're there. You know, even though Fitbit does it, like, you would think that the watch would be able to do it in a more sophisticated way, like with better data presentation and like more insights, you know, from the data. It's disappointing that, you know, part of the story is, nothing this year. and Mark's usually pretty good on this timing, you know, not just the surgery, but also when, you know, if anything, like things get pushed back, not moved up. So, I guess not for this year, at least. Maybe
next year. Like, it's hard to think. We haven't really heard of any like WatchOS 6 rumors yet.
Right.
But for me, it was like, maybe it's going to be sleep tracking is going to be their like big thing.
Yeah. I mean, the opportunities are always on display in some way. You know, the obvious answer is that only part of it lights up with the time and maybe, you know, select complications and not more information. And then when you raise your wrist, you get the full display lights up. And they've not done that yet at all. You know, third party watch faces, they're not tackled at all, even though that isn't hardware. It's an opportunity. But this year so far, we just have Ming-Chi Kuo saying ceramic will be back, which has no effect on aluminum and steel customers, and that the ECG app will be in more countries, which has no effect on Series 4 US customers. So we have nothing yet really for a lot of the most of the Apple Watch customers in the US yet.
It's certainly a puzzle. Yeah. I mean, like WatchOS 5 had... you know, a fair few features, but it wasn't like a cavalcade, an endless stream of stuff. Like, I remember the original pitch, you just had, you know, three sections, essentially. They had the activity challenges, then they had the kind of walkie-talkie and, like, podcast app, and then they had you know, the few extra changes like getting control center from anywhere and stuff like that. Like
it wasn't the Siri face, but no other.
Yeah, and the updates to the Siri face
until
yeah.
the watch
it,
came out.
Yeah. yeah, but it's not. It's not they like. Unfortunately, watchOS does not get the kind of same kind of attention that iOS does. Like iOS has literally like laundry list of feature after feature after feature, and we're setting up for another big release this year. The watch doesn't quite have that, and there are three big things you mentioned. You know, custom watch faces, always on. And then sleep tracking, these feel like key software features that the Apple Watch currently lacks that all of the wearable competition already do. Like the Android watches, as bad as they are, they have great always-on options like grayscale, clock face options. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Apple Watch just has nothing on that regard. And it's like, if they could tackle one of those three this year, I'd be really, really happy. I don't really care which, but, you know, it doesn't look like sleep tracking is going to be it.
Yeah, yeah. So I recently did a week... and a few days experience with only the Apple Watch, out of necessity, when my iPhone was in transit, and, which we might discuss another time, but it did give me some insight into like what using the Apple Watch activated, but with no iPhone on Wi-Fi or LTE is like, and even with LTE, like there were some pretty significant limitations. Like, for example, the news app never refreshed. So like the news app on the Apple Watch, it's only 5 headlines and like images, and you can save a story to read in full on the iPhone. So it isn't that much, you know, there to it. And, but it's also part of the Siri watch face. It's like, as it refreshes, it appears as a tile in the Siri face. Without an iPhone on Wi-Fi or LTE, like on a network, the news app is just done. Like it doesn't refresh on its own, which is kind of weird considering like, All watches can be on Wi-Fi, and a lot of watches are on LTE as well. My reminders never would sync. I could add them to the watch, or I could add them to the iPad or Mac, but they would never. The Mac and iPad would talk, obviously, but like the reminders app just doesn't talk to the server on its own to iCloud. It just talks to the phone, and it's like, you know, we got LTE with the Series 3, and music streaming came in the next big point update to that version of the software with the Series 3. But then it was a year later when we got podcast streaming, and they've just been kind of like not super fast on how fast they take advantage of having, you know, watches that are always on the network that are closer to like miniature iPhones. And so, you know, if nothing, and also like, just with the podcast app, I've had experiences where because you can't force the podcast app on the watch to refresh, it can be very frustrating. It's capable of streaming like on demand with Siri, but if you subscribe to shows, it can be very difficult to say your phone knows you have a new episode of a podcast available and you want to listen to it on the watch away from your phone. You're at the mercy of like when the watch gets the signal to look for it.
It's like it almost waits for the phone to tell the watch that there's a new episode there. Like,
right. Even though it downloads directly to the watch, you know, it can over Wi-Fi or LTE for streaming even. It's looking for a signal there. So there's, it's like just look at the watch and look at the way the software works and just try to make it more independent, even if you still require an iPhone, because, you know, there's, the watch isn't getting further from the iPhone. Like with the ECG, you do it on the watch, but then you see the data for the most part, the report on the iPhone. You know, it's, you know, maybe you could have it go through Wi-Fi or LTE to, you know, the cloud and back down to whatever device you wanted to. But for the moment, like the watch is getting more dependent on the phone, not less. But it does seem like performance wise that like, because all like, even when streaming music came to the watch, that benefited people on Wi-Fi too. Like you could be on the gym on Wi-Fi and stream music, or at home, you know, without your phone and stream music. That's one thing I would like to see, is two parts to it. Just that the software looks at every app and says, you know, with no iPhone, with the iPhone dead, you know, iPhone gone, stolen, whatever, the watch is as capable as if the iPhone was here. That I think that should be a thing. And also, there's I forget the name of it, there's a speed test app you can use for the watch and like see what your download speed is and upload speed. And it's super slow. Like even for LTE, it's like, you know, it's very slow. So any improvements to like how fast it can connect, like, it's like you can do a phone call, you can do a FaceTime audio call, you know, and you can stream audio. It's all possible. But it, the initial connection, it can be much slower in the same area. And also just like the speed itself, like the peak speed seems to be like way lower. So there seems to be some serious opportunities to like take LTE and cellular connectivity on the watch that's been there for now 2 years and like crank it way up in terms of what you're capable of doing, because it can be a very limited product once you remove the iPhone for, you know, if it's dead or if it's stolen or if it's just in transit. Like it actually should be fine to like rely on your iPhone for a week with your iPhone like out for repair or something if you needed to. Yeah. But that's kind of tricky right now with how limited the watch can suddenly become.
And that experience is what they evangelize to third-party developers. Like, make your apps iPhone independent and talk directly to the network on the watch when the network is available. But like a lot of the Apple apps haven't been updated to use that stuff, and they still rely on talking to the iPhone. Like they won't show you the screen of like the WatchOS 1 days where it's like you need to an iPhone in range just to see the app.
Yeah.
But they tend to rely on, oh, to actually update a lot of the data, your iPhone needs to be nearby. Like, didn't you mention that reminders wouldn't sync?
Exactly, reminders wouldn't sync. So I could add everything to the reminders app on the watch, and then that was like my reminders bucket. But then on the iPad or the Mac, it was its own thing. So
yeah, which is ridiculous. Like, yeah, you should just do it.
Yeah, and like mail would work. So you know, and messages would work for iMessage, and if you have an iPhone on the network, then SMS would work as well. But I think like the iCloud mail was fine, but like Gmail would never update. Yeah, and that might just be its own issue. But you know, they're doing it right, and it can be slow too. Like if you don't have the message on the phone first, or if it's still the best case scenario is to have a phone nearby and so everything to relate to the phone, and that it's the experience isn't optimized yet to be watch only, and you know, for more than like an hour or two, but like not for like days at a time.
Here's what I hear. I'm at home still, right? But I leave my phone in my office, and mm-hmm. I'm walking around, and you send me a picture on iMessage, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Messages app on the watch does not let you zoom in.
That's true. You can double tap to like expand a little bit, but you can't pan and zoom.
Yeah, with, like, the crown. You have a digital crown. I just want to be able to scroll the crown and actually zoom in, because normally you're sending me a funny screenshot and I can fill the screen by double tapping, but it is not zooming in enough for me to actually read anything. Yeah. And it is so frustrating. It's like the watch has downloaded the image. It has the image on the screen. All I want to be able to do is just zoom in a little bit. And there's so many like random niggles like that, that, you know, we're like 5 years into the watch software and stuff like that is still problematic. Like,
they figured it out on the Photos app, like from day one, that you can pan and zoom with a crown and your finger in a picture, but not in a screenshot. I often get sent a message, and this happened when the iPhone was away and I just had the watch, but it would say view on your iPhone, you know, and it's that the message, I think it's that it hasn't downloaded in a certain amount of time. And so it wants you to either manually download it on the watch, but then it just says to go view it on your iPhone, even though you can see it on your watch. But it's not going to show you in the preview. You need to tap and download it, which can be very slow because the cellular connection is not fast. Even if it's steady and constant, it's not fast. So yeah, big opportunities there. Maybe this will be an S year for the watch. last year was a big redesign. So if this year they took the fundamentals and just made it all better, I wouldn't complain and I would upgrade.
You mean on the hardware side?
Yeah,
I think that'd be fine. Like if they just did a speed bump update for the hardware plus some new bands and casing styles.
And looked at the software returning. And said, like, if we were making the software today with cellular in mind, you know, apply that to everything that already exists, you know.
Yeah. And obviously faster hardware in general. Like,
yeah, that seems kind of like built in that you're going to get that. And I think we're also kind of at a...
I meant like software features taking advantage of the fact that everything's just faster now.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Because the hardware, the chip wise, like the first one was pretty bad. And the second, like for like series 2 and 3, you felt the speed differences, but like series 3 to series 4, you're really starting to get like a smaller return year over year than you had before. And it's, you know, series 5, I guess we'll get to. I think we'll still see speed benefits year over year, but I think we'll soon get to like where it feels like on the iPhone, where it's like a continuum, you know, where it doesn't feel like it's a major leap, but it's just like you know, yeah, it's an iPhone. It feels like day one iPhone.
Yeah, and like the reason you're suggesting S Year is fine is that it just feels like, it kind of feels like the iPad equivalent, where like the hardware is really powerful or powerful enough, and it's just the software that's holding it back. And
sure, yeah.
That's kind of where the watch is at the moment. So I'm really hoping there's big stuff in store for WatchOS 6, but it sure doesn't seem like sleep tracking's crossed off the list. So now we've got to hope for custom watch faces.
Well, they've got a lot of spare time without doing sleep tracking for the watch this year, at least. So. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can give us feedback at happyhour@95mac.com. We read all your emails, and you can tweet at us on Twitter. I'm at @ApolloZach. Benjamin, you are?
BZA Mayo.
And with that being said, we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.